Okay, so this is the last episode of Trek About. We are talking about Star Trek Nemesis. I'm sure that we will have a very spirited discussion about the movie, about its place in the Star Trek canon, about Star Trek as a whole, about TNG, about Trek About, about why the show is ending. But I want to start this out by mentioning something to Richard, which I just found out last week. And a listener actually told me this that I met in real life. Don't get too excited. It's a friend. It's a friend's boyfriend.
That doesn't mean anything.
Well, it doesn't mean anything. That's true. But I think this person will know who they are. Guinan doesn't have eyebrows.
I don't honestly notice eyebrows on anybody. Like, Eugene Levy is like the level you need to be where I notice eyebrows, but
I'm kind of the same way. But I mention it because, of course, Guinan makes a brief appearance in Nemesis at the beginning. And the fact that Whoopi Goldberg either doesn't have eyebrows or shaves her eyebrows,
but I mean,
is striking because I had literally never noticed it before. I think because I was distracted by her amazing hats.
Yeah, exactly. If anything, I assume that the hat brim came on over the eyebrows. I mean, women do this, right? Like, they will shave their eyebrows and draw on the eyebrows. Like, I've been watching 100% Hotter. They do that. I don't get it, but you know, it's a thing about life.
Well, Richard, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. So there you go. So Nemesis. I don't think I have seen this movie since it came out 16 years ago. Because I remembered it being terrible and I remembered hating it. And watching it again 16 years later, after sitting through after sitting through Voyager, I don't think Nemesis is a great movie. I don't even necessarily think it's a good movie, but it's adequate.
Well, I was thinking about this a lot because, I mean, I read Roger Ebert's review of this, and it is amazingly bitchy. You really need to read it if you not. Like, he says, basically, I've been watching episodes where for 30 years I've been watching these people have their shields fail on them, and we're always worried about the power of the shields. And, you know, Patrick Stewart is a great actor. Everybody says he's great. When he does terrible material, why can't they give him good material? And Ebert is exhausted of Star Trek, right, in his review.
So I just have to say that the actual quote, I don't have it in front of me, but I also read it last night, and it's something like, everyone says that Patrick Stewart's strength is making bad material sound great. I say it's time to stop encouraging him, which is just like an amazing line.
Yeah,
but anyway.
He ends that paragraph saying, this man has played Shakespeare, you know? So this movie came out in 2002. And when we had done the podcast on the X-Files movie, Fight the Future, one of the things I had said was that in a year, The Matrix is going to come out and it's going to knock science fiction film on its ass, both in terms of the kinds of stories it's telling, in terms of the way it's filming itself. And 2002, we are a year from the two Matrix sequels and Kill Bill, and a general interest in that whole kind of more martial arts, wire foo kind of stuff. And put in that context, this particular movie just feels – would probably felt extremely dated at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it did feel dated. And I think that it's interesting, right, because this was the first Star Trek movie in a long time that – wasn't directed by someone who had been involved in Star Trek. You know, Jonathan Frakes had directed Insurrection First Contact. I honestly don't remember who directed Generations, but it was, you know, no one that impressive, I don't think. Apologies if, like, I don't know if Coppola directed it or something. And this was also written by someone who I believe had never written for Star Trek before. While this writer was a fan of Star Trek and obviously knows his stuff, he had never written for Star Trek before. And so I think it's a weird mixture of the Star Trek, quote unquote, style of visual storytelling, visual filmmaking, while at the same time having some minor nods to make the film feel more dynamic. I think probably the best example of this is the much maligned and made fun of Dune buggy sequence, which would not have been out of place in a number of other science fiction movies. And, you know, it's got this the color gradient. It's all sort of like washed out.
Yeah,
and
I didn't know how to talk about this, but that whole planet looks very different than any other Star Trek before. Even the films, like, you can't just say it's a budget thing. It's filmed differently.
Yeah, like, they were definitely not trying to hide the fact that they filmed it in, you know, Southern California. They deliberately washed the colors out. They sort of used like a handheld style. And so, yeah, it definitely feels a little different in some places, but I think that for the most part, it's still very much a Berman-era Star Trek production.
It's a weird uncanny valley of it to me because it's – I mean, I guess my big question, which is going to inform a lot of my thoughts on this, is did they know that this is probably the last time out for the next-gen crew?
No.
So as far as they knew, there was going to be a movie in 2 years where we – picked up the adventures of Picard and B4 and what's happening to on Riker's and all of that.
Yes, okay. That is what I understand. Like, so if you look at it, right? So then, Generations came out in 94. First Contact came out in 96. Insurrection came out in 98. And then you have this 4-year gap between Insurrection and Nemesis. And obviously that was partially because Insurrection did not do as well in financially as they were hoping. And Nemesis did even worse than that. And that basically killed TNG's movies.
Yeah. And that was all we really heard of movies till 07, 09?
09, yeah.
Okay.
So they didn't know that this was going to be the last outing for the TNG crew. I believe that Patrick Stewart has said that there was an idea for another movie, although Nemesis is the one that I know the least about in terms of the sort of like behind the scenes stuff, because frankly, I saw it once and didn't care for it, and so just didn't ever really paid much attention to it. And it also came at a very weird point because at this point Voyager was off the air. Voyager had been off the air for quite a while, over a year, I think. This movie came out, I think, in December of 2002, and Voyager would have ended in May of 2001. And they were working on Enterprise, of course. Enterprise was not 24th century. Enterprise looked very different from this movie. And when Nemesis kind of feels like the last gasp of this kind of thing. And I kind of, one of the things I want to talk about with this episode is how Star Trek died, because I think that Trekabout is ending for very similar reasons to why Star Trek eventually died.
Yeah. And I think there is, because there's a lot of subtext of that in the movie too, right? Like this begins with Riker and Troy getting married, and Riker is getting his own ship. Troy is going to be leaving. Picard needs a new first officer. It's going to be Data, who himself dies at the end of this episode. Like, there are a lot of end of an era kind of resonances in this movie.
And yeah, but it's all unfinished, right?
But that has to do with I think that's this movie in general. One of the reasons I asked is if they knew this was the last one, it is because it feels like they are cramming in a lot of shit because they think this is our last hurrah, when it's then knowing that they might have thought, oh yeah, we're having another movie after this, it feels bloated and just aimless. It's not about there are too many things happening and none of them are followed up on. And that theme of the band breaking up, but in a way that doesn't lead to the sadness of all good things, should have been a proper theme.
Yeah, but at the same time, though, I don't think that having Riker and Troy leave the Enterprise, for instance, is that odd in conjunction with or in context with the original series movies. Because remember, like, the Undiscovered Country had Sulu captaining his own ship. Chekhov in Star Trek II was off doing other things.
Yeah,
and so it wasn't always the case that they were all still serving on the same ship 20 years later.
But I guess what I'm saying is this is the all good things ends with them realizing that we drifted apart too far, and this movie is about getting to a point where they are starting to drift, because that is what's going to happen in their lives. But with the events of All Good Things in their memories, they're going to stay. Like, just because Riker's getting his own ship doesn't mean that that's the last time they're going to see each other. No, Picard and Riker and Troy and everybody are going to make damn sure that, you know, if Voyager can have yearly reunions, then the Enterprise crew is going to have yearly reunions too. They're going to be in their each other's lives for a very long time. At the same time, it is things changing. And I guess that's this movie almost feels like it wants to be in two camps. It wants to be a rip-roaring next-gen story, but it also needs to be talking about what's coming next, and it doesn't have any answers for what's coming next. And again, given where sci-fi is going to go into some incredibly dark places with The Matrix, with Battlestar Galactica, with things like that, with even where... I mean, this movie needs to be what Star Trek 09 was, right? And it doesn't do it.
Yeah, because I don't think that Rick Berman had to have control wrested from him, and of course he did after the failure of Enterprise. But I mean, I don't disagree with you about all of that stuff. But I also think that for my perspective, it will be interesting to see what the Picard series is going to be about, because. You know, I've always said that Nemesis was a bad send-off for TNG and that they deserve a better one. And they've been making a lot of noise about how this is not a TNG reunion show. This is specifically a Picard series. All these kind of things, right? But I also think that you're going to see these people in the movie or in the series, right?
Oh, like, yeah. Marina Sirtis is coming by.
Yeah, like Marina Sirtis made guest appearances in Star Trek Voyager, for God's sake. Yeah. So, and... Star Trek Enterprise, yeah, but we'll never get to that, but you know that now.
You think Michael Dorn is going to miss an opportunity to play Captain Worf, even if it's just for one scene? I mean, at the very least, they can easily cameo these people in, you know, in the way that Janeway cameos in this movie, for example. They really just need one day of a monologue.
Yeah, and let's dispense with Janeway very quickly. She's now an admiral. Good for her.
It backs up that everybody got instant promotions once they landed on Earth, and I think it's a little funny that you know, she is an admiral over Picard, who is, you know, much more experienced. But at the same time, and this could be part of if they wanted to actually make that about the theme. I can picture Picard making damn sure that this is where his career is going to stay for a while. He's the captain of the flagship of the Federation. He's happy with his crew. He's very content in that. And, you know, at some point he will get his admiralship, but he's going to pass by those promotion opportunities. Again, maybe I think this shows that I'm interested in different questions than this movie is, because by the end of TNG, we knew exactly why Riker, for all of his talents, is still just the first officer. We know damn well, because this is where he's happy. This is where he is thriving. And I think, I don't know, I'm interested in the fact that Picard, after meeting up with Kirk, may stay as a captain for a while. He knows what the admiralship is. Janeway is somebody who, yeah, after Voyager, probably would be happy to be having a desk job and teaching at the academy for a while.
And that's why I think that what I've been hearing about the nascent Picard series gives me a little bit of hope, because, you know, aside from the fact that Michael Chabon is writing for it, and he's like one of the finest American novelists living and writing today, which is just like, how did that happen? But I mean, not to say how did that happen that he's writing on Star Trek, but that they're saying the right things about, like, it's not going to be what you expect. You know, Picard's not going to be an admiral. He's not going to be flying around the galaxy in on the Enterprise, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll just have to see. I mean, we don't know. And I think that's why Nemesis is so weird, because the movie raises all of these questions that we are finally going to get some answers to in a year or two. And
yeah,
I don't know if, because you said that you're interested in different questions than this movie is answering. And I agree with you. I also am interested in different questions, but I think that the real failing of Nemesis is that I don't know what questions it is asking.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I mean, it's a goddamn mess. So there's normally we talk. It's hard to get into because there's there are two major threads that I don't think are. God, how the fuck am I talking about? So basically, the fact that I haven't been able to complete a sentence, that's how I felt the movie was. Like, the entire last paragraph of what I just said is this movie.
Because, like, on a very fundamental level, I don't know what this movie is about.
Okay, let me ask. Here is a question which is buried in Star Trek Nemesis and which, again, in an era where The Matrix is a very popular thing a lot of people are thinking about. Identity and what makes a person. Okay, so we have two sets of doubles in this movie. We have Data and Before, and we have Picard and Shinzon. And these pairs are made of exactly the same material genetically or positronically or however they're created, but they're created at the same point, and yet at some point there is a split in their timelines, which means that the two have extraordinarily different life circumstances and end up as completely different people. Now, the movie wants to ask the question of, does your environment and your experiences make who you are, or is there a core nugget of something, maybe a soul or whatever it is, that remains the same throughout? And this is part of where Picard is trying to get to Shinzon throughout the movie. Like the scene where he says, you know, if I'm a mirror to you, you're a mirror to me. Like, what I am is what you could be. And he's trying the entire movie to appeal to Shinzon's decency. And it never works. Shinzon never does the thing. Shinzon never becomes better than his circumstances. And so therefore the movie is saying it's just based on what happens to you. Picard had all of these advantages, had a much better life than Shinzon did, and so became a moral paragon. Shinzon was abused his entire life, and so he's an evil asshole. Whether or not...
But I also think that, I mean, part of what's so galling about this movie, though, is that it completely ignores the reason why Picard became a different person.
Tapestry.
I.e. that he was stabbed in the heart and almost died. And that would obviously have a profound effect on someone, I think. And so, I mean, whatever, it's not really that important to the movie, and I can kind of understand why they left that out. I mean, they do have that scene in Picard's ready room with him and Beverly where he's looking wistfully at the picture of himself in his Academy uniform and saying, remember this guy? And, you know, he was arrogant and he was an asshole and he desperately needed seasoning and all those sorts of things. And I think that's really what is so disappointing about the main plot of Nemesis, which is that Shinzon isn't a very interesting character, and he really should be. I mean, you know, this is a very, very early Tom Hardy before he bulked up. I mean, he's, you know, he's very pretty and he looks wonderful in the movie and everything, but it just doesn't, and he gives a good performance with the material that he's given, but we never really know what his motivations are, and it just seems to be that he is using... I mean, is he using the Remans, and is he using the Federation just in order to get to Picard to get his DNA to help cure him? Like, I guess it's just coming from a very logical place of, does the person who wrote this movie understand that if Shinzon sent a message to Starfleet Command and said, hey, I'm a clone of Captain Picard and I'm dying of a disease that I need Captain Picard's DNA to help me cure. Like, they would be all over that shit.
Well, here's the thing. They utterly failed to... The Viceroy is another character that they utterly failed to characterize, and maybe this is...
Yeah, the not to cut you off, but the Remans piss me off because the Remans are just like, ooh, scary aliens.
Well, we have to talk about the Remans at some point, too, because I have questions. But the Viceroy, I feel like if Shinzon was this guy who was under the influence of the Viceroy, who is the person who wants to deal a massive damage to the Romulans, deal a massive damage to Earth, and we are going to take control and all the... Make him an evil chancellor. and then have Shinzon as the as this kid, frankly, who, you know, is raised by this guy, does owe this guy his life, but is being influenced to do the bad thing because that's what he's been told this entire life. And then Picard himself represents the good mentor, the person that is going to convince him to overthrow. I mean, the real big bad of this movie should be the Viceroy, not Shinzon.
Yeah. I
and that gives Shinzon a character arc. That gives him an opportunity, and that gives an opportunity to say, there is a core of decency inside you, and frankly, and implicitly, through everyone, and it is our job as the Federation to find these people and give them the good moral upbringing, because when you're being ignored, you fall through the cracks and then start reading Steve Bannon's column and vote for Trump. Like, that is what this movie is about to me in 2018. And it's the theme that the movie utterly fails to do. This movie utterly fails to predict Trump, and maybe it's unfair to blame it on that, but I don't think it understands its villain psychology at all.
Well, and that is, I think that's part of the issue, right? That this movie has a villain, and I'm going to make an observation that I did not originate. I forget where I read this, but I read it somewhere a long time ago, that part of the issue with so many of the Next Generation movies and even the original series movies is that they fell into the trap of trying to replicate the success of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
You know, Wrath of Khan is a great movie, right? But it's a great movie because Ricardo Montalban gives a great performance. It is tied back to a period of Kirk's past. It asks hard questions about how Kirk is a captain, the aging process, all of these things, right? And Spock dies at the end. It's just like, it's a fantastically put together movie. I mean, if you haven't listened to our episode on it, go back and listen to it. I think we recorded it in 1968. But
yeah, the true villain of Wrath of Khan in its way is also the no-win scenario is the villain in that, right? Like, Khan is the secondary villain to that larger theme, and it ties in, and which makes Khan a much more resonant villain.
But that's the thing, is like, they kept trying to replicate the success of Wrath of Khan. They took the wrong lessons from it. They thought it was successful because Khan was a really good villain, and they keep giving us villains, right? I mean, that's why we got Sorn in Generations. That's why we got the Borg Queen. Insurrection kind of doesn't fit, but that's why we get Shinzon. I mean, and so it's taking the wrong lessons from Wrath of Khan. And like you said, right, like, Wrath of Khan's real villain is not Khan. Kirk is asking important questions about himself in that movie. It is the no-win scenario. That is the thing that just kind of permeates under the surface of the entire movie. This movie, what is Picard supposed to learn from this? What is the lesson that he needs to learn?
Yeah.
Is he just supposed to, like, pat himself on the back for being a good guy? I don't get it.
At least Generations may have been a awkward movie, but at least it dealt with Picard dealing with his captain's choice of, I can have the family and the stable home, or I can have the exciting Starfleet career. I made this choice. Do I regret this choice? I mean, that's much more than Nemesis ever did. I mean, this actually puts it into an interesting context, because what's the other than Wrath of Khan, what is the best Star Trek movie? And that's Voyage Home. Who's the villain in that one? It's a probe that's a vague metaphor for global warming and saving the whales, but it's a, you know, that's a MacGuffin, right? It's an excuse to get into the 20th century and talk about the excesses of the 20th century leading to disaster ultimately, and how the Roddenberry future is the thing which is going to save us from that. Again, maybe that's a bit of an earnest theme, but it is a very different story from Wrath of Khan.
Yeah. I mean, I will defend Nemesis a little bit, because aside from the issue of the movie not really knowing what the point of the character of Shinzon is and what that's supposed to say about Picard, I do think that the movie did answer the criticism a little bit of what to do with the rest of the characters. You know, we made this observation again and again when we talked about TNG movies, but part of the issue with them is that they have too many characters to service and they don't do a very good job of it. I think that this movie makes a pretty clear decision. almost everybody gets a little moment, and the movie is primarily about Picard and Data, but of course the movie starts out with Riker and Troy getting married. We see Guinan there. We see Wesley Crusher, you know, in the background.
Troy gets a few nice moments and creepy moments, and
we'll have to talk about her plot because I have problems with it, but whatever. But she gets an actual thing to do that is grounded in the reality of her character. You know, Worf has a little funny moment. Geordi's kind of shortchanged by the movie, as is Beverly. But on the whole, I think it does a better job of integrating all of them into the story as opposed to a lot of the other TNG movies.
Yeah, and that's true. And, you know, if Dr. Crusher doesn't have a real big part on it, maybe the follow-up to this would have been a Dr. Crusher movie. I don't know.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, I would watch that now. Yeah. But no.
But I guess the flip side to the theme with Shinzon is, and whether or not Shinzon could have been good or not, is that the whole before plot seems to be the exact opposite of that. In other words, you know, yes, he is made of the same stuff as Data and imaged from him, but Data makes this point about, you know, Data's the one who explicitly says the theme of, you know, we may have started at the same point, but then our lives became different, and it doesn't matter where we came from, we're different people. And yet at the end of the movie, his whistling of this song that Data had been singing is used to represent that there is at least something essential to Data. Specifically, we can extrapolate that to be Data's questing to better himself, his bravery, his sacrificing himself for his loved ones and all of that. That quest of Data-ness, something of that essentially does still remain. And so even though Before and Data are two different people, there is a core soul of goodness in the two of them, which is the exact opposite of the Shinzon thing. And so I guess I wish the movie had picked a side, because it looks like it can say, well, we don't know either. It could be this, it could be that.
Yeah, and I wonder about the Before stuff for various reasons. But I think the end of the movie, as you mentioned, is weird, because, you know, early on in the movie, they find Before, they download Data's memories into Before. And, you know, the whole thing is like, it's going to take him a long time to process all of this data. Oh, okay, sure, whatever. And then at the end of the movie, like, he's still Before, but then he starts singing because he's remembering this moment of Data's, right? And the implication being, like, I think at the end of the movie, Picard is looking at Before singing and helping him out and singing along with him, and it's this nice little moment where Picard gets a little bit of closure over the death of his close friend. But I don't think the movie is arguing that Before and Data are the same person. However, I also think that I don't really understand what the point of Before is, because this is something that I struggle with, because I have heard conflicting things about this, notably that the reason Data dies in this movie, and we haven't really dealt with the fact that Data is dead. The reason that Data dies in this movie is because Brent Spiner felt like he was getting too old to play Data.
Yeah.
All right, sure, fine, whatever.
Well, but especially when you have a character who is supposed to be ageless. I mean, he probably could not have gained much. Like, you can't gain weight if you have that role, right? You can't get wrinkles.
Well, I think there actually is an episode where they say that Data can age. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I do think that introducing Before into the movie is just like a mindfuck situation. Because if Brent Spiner wanted to leave because he was getting too old to play Data, why introduce the other?
Well, you know how it, and again, Wrath of Khan is a much better version of that. But the whole where they seed and remember and all of that. And I mean, that was done because Nimoy wasn't sure if he wanted to continue the character or not. And that was kind of the escape.
Yep.
Yeah, escape clause. So in other words, if Nimoy never returned to Star Trek, then remember just becomes a moment of, you know, he's saying goodbye to his friend. With Search for Spock, it becomes he's seeding his Katra into, okay, I wonder if that is the case here. In other words, yes, Brent Spiner is saying, no, I never want to play this character again. They put B4 in as a way of giving Data his sacrifice, but if they decide to drive a truckload of money up to Brent Spiner's house and he wants to say yes, they'll make it happen. And he can
Well, isn't that the problem with Nemesis at its core then? It's a movie that doesn't make any decisions.
Yeah.
Like, they kill Data, but here's B4, right? Like,
this is how
they kill Shin Zan, but Picard's still here. What lessons did we learn? I don't know. Like, and it's just, you know, the Remans are this, and then the Remans are that, and the Romulans are this, and then the Romulans are helping us, and it's just like, it's all very muddled.
Oh, God. So, yeah, the Romulan lady, what is her name?
Donatello. I think she's a Teenage Mutant Ninja
Okay,
Turtle.
Well, Leonardo.
I think her name is actually Sinatra, but yeah.
Sinatra. She makes... I don't understand her motivations from scene to scene. So number one, opening scene, she assassinates the Senate, right? And these are people that she is fellow senators of. People that she knows and has worked with, right? She assassinates the Senate in order to allow Shin Zan to take power. Okay, the next scene, she's there. She's talking with him. She seems he seems to be kind of recognizing that she's uncomfortable. She tries to seduce him. It fails. She realizes how dangerous it is. Another scene, she talks to one of the other guys who's working with him, and that's when she says, you know, gee, this means the annihilation of Earth. He's not just going to take over. This is the beginning of something bad. Are you okay with this? And then she's gone in on the Federation side. Okay, I sort of understand her arc, but there are a lot of missing pieces here.
Yeah, I feel like probably, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but I feel like about 20 minutes of scenes featuring her were cut out of the movie or something. I don't know, and I agree with you. I mean, I think that make this a movie about the Romulans. Like, make this the undiscovered country of TNG, because the Romulans have always been underserved by Star Trek. They are a long-standing thing in Star Trek. I believe they have been in Star Trek longer than the Klingons, but they've always been treated as sort of an afterthought. And, you know, here is the movie where we are going to find out a lot about the Romulans. They're going to get a Romulan plot. We're actually going to see the Remans, which we still need to talk about the Remans, but not yet. But,
well,
and then what happens is that the movie gets hijacked by all of this other extraneous nonsense. And I struggle with her character for various reasons, but primarily I struggle with it because I agree that I don't think her motivations make any sense. And what I mean by that is there is a line in the movie, I forget who says it, I think it's Picard, but it could have been someone else, that the power of the Romulan Chancellor, or is it Chancellor? I forget. We'll
Praetor,
just say Chancellor.
I think it was the...
Praetor, yeah, Prelate, thank something you, Praetor. Like that. The power of the Romulan Praetor has always been the Romulan fleet, right? And here we are led to believe that let's say, for example, like the Praetor comes up through the Senate, right? And so we have like a parliamentary system or something, and I'm gonna get really like political geeky right now. So Sinatra kills all the senators who are all conveniently in the room at the same time, and also the Praetor, who is the leader of the Senate, let's say. Okay, fine. She's a senator, right? So she's the only remaining senator that is still alive. And so there's no one else to take the role of Praetor. So you're imagining this already, that this is sort of a power play situation, right? And part of the reason why Romulan Praetors rise and fall so quickly is because all of the senators have their own little deals with parts of the fleet, and it's competition all the time. And, you know, they have their commanders and this, that, and the other thing. It's kind of like a Roman situation, I guess. So Shin Zan like flies in with his giant, you know, MacGuffin Deus Ex Machina ship and takes control because everyone is confused and disoriented because the entire Romulan Senate has been killed in a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
But then why can't Denatra like get the fleet to help her?
Well, because the other
yes, she wants Shin Zan to be the leader of the Romulans, and so she is going to use her power as the sole remaining senator to let the fleet back off, right, and let Shinzon be the leader of the Romulans for a while. But then, like, why does she only have two ships at the end of the movie?
Listen,
it doesn't make any sense.
I guess so. The other guy that she, again, the guy that she makes the he's going to annihilate Earth speech to, I assumed he was like the head general. Like, he's the head of the Romulan fleet, and he's
sure.
So what I'm assuming the where Romulus is right now governmentally seems to be at least a uneasy peace with the Federation. Like, we don't feel like antagonizing the Federation. The Federation does want – it's a period of detente, we assume.
Well, this is also, you know, only a couple years after the end of the Dominion War.
Yeah. So they may just feel like, they work together on the Dominion War. They're getting closer. All right. There's some factions in Romulus that feel that they don't quite want this relationship. Let's pretend that Denatra is one of those who feels a little uncomfortable. It's a little weird that she's so willing to work with Picard at the end of the movie then, because that's a very complete change of heart. But yeah, let's say she is a Republican who wants certain tax breaks done and wants a bathroom separate and has a couple of things that she wants, and she sees Donald Trump is going to be able to get these things passed. Okay. She and the general accept Shinzon's bid for power as the last remaining member of the Senate, as the head of the fleet. They are able to kind of make this coup happen. As things go on, she realizes, no, we're getting a lot further worse. He's actually going to lead the Empire to his doom. You know, it may be nice to get power, but at too great of a cost. You know, maybe she want. You know, she's fine making some blows against Earth, but she doesn't want to destroy Earth. Sure, okay, fine. Yeah. Except all of that doesn't square with the fact that she didn't just simply do a yes vote. She did kill the Senate herself, right? Like, that was – she didn't just call in sick at the meeting and just happen to be alive, you know, and that was the conspiracy. She activated the bomb.
Right.
So
yeah.
I don't – so doesn't her change of heart seem a little too late in light of that? She didn't just kill one guy. She killed everybody in the room.
The only thing that I can really – the only way that I can really square that circle is because Shinzon –
I mean,
he knows what to say to people to get that to get them to do what he wants them to do. I think that's like kind of one of the things that he is good at in this movie. And, you know, aside from being a conduit for the Viceroy's, you know, magic psychic powers, which again, Jesus Christ, we'll get to that. But I do think that you know, Shinzon does say to Picard, and the way that they get the Enterprise there is that they say that they're making overtures of peace to the Federation. So maybe. Right. Like the Praetor that they had, the Praetor that they killed was a hardline anti-Federationist. And, you know, he was part of the anti-Federationist party or whatever. And she was not. And she was very, you know, she saw the fires of the Dominion War and how well the Federation and the Romulans work side by side. And she's come around to the idea of an alliance between the Romulans and the Federation. And so here comes Shinzon. And they hatch this plan because he tells her that he is also, you know, really excited about the idea of a Romulan Federation alliance. And then, of course, as it turns out, the only thing he really wants is to kidnap Picard. And then she realizes that and she goes over and helps Picard. That's the only
thing.
Eric,
I want to see this movie so badly. Like, this is a really fucking interesting movie.
Yeah, like, isn't this a much better movie?
Where she's the main character and the TNG crew are just the deuteragonist would have been a fucking fascinating movie.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And like, and it also, I mean, let's move on to the weird sexual politics of Nemesis, because I also think that having a woman main character in the form of Denatra the Romulan would have been a very interesting way to sidestep a lot of the issues that this movie steps its foot into.
Yeah. I mean, Christ, I'm thinking about even First Contact had that, the woman who is what's-his-name's assistant, right? Like, who ends up with Picard through most of it. If Denatra had that level of a role in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. And as it stands, she has like three scenes. And I mean, it's even hard to sort of like believe that it's the same person from scene to scene.
Yeah, there's a reason that I've asked to confirm three times that she was the one who put up the stone bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, she was, the Thalion radiation. Because where else would she have gotten? Where else would that person have gotten it from, right? Like,
that was the whole Shinzon thing. Okay. I didn't realize that that was that radio. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that, so, gee, that's something the movie could have made clearer, too. But anyway.
The movie is good for about 5 minutes, and then like it starts to fall apart. So let's talk about Troy's mind rape. Because...
Yeah.
I think that the end result is okay and gives her something kind of interesting to do, but I also don't feel very comfortable with it for various reasons.
Well,
but I will say that that the one reason that is sort of like impacts the movie the most is that, remember back in Generations, the very beginning of the movie, Picard finds out that his entire family died in a fire, and that is one of the most emotionally manipulative things a writer can do, is just to have their family die in a fire. And we're like, what the fuck is this? Why did they do this? And this movie does kind of a similar thing, where it wants to make Shinzon and the Reman out to be a really bad dude.
Yeah.
And the way they do it is by putting Troy into some sort of mind rape territory.
Yeah. And
I'm not really here for that. I don't appreciate that.
And the movie goes out of its way for that, though, because it's fine if Troy realizes that she's being, you know, he's seeing through her, he's spying through her, right? Like, that can feel violating and horrible, and it's a whole nother level to have, while she's in the middle of making love to her new husband, have him appear. Like that not only is bad from a Shinzon and Troy perspective, that's going to put weird rifts that I just don't want in Riker and Troy, because I'm finally glad those two kids have gotten together and they deserve some happiness. And when she's talking to Picard and everybody about it afterwards, she explicitly said it was a violation. She doesn't use the word rape, but because, I mean, I thought that was a really awesome scene on, you know, her part, because she's all but saying it because she's not really yet able to say the word and deal with it quite there, but she's edging against it. And, you know, while I get the place of Picard saying, well, gee, can you endure it again? Because this is a man who does have to ask people to go into situations where they can be killed. It is still a little hard to watch.
It is hard to watch. And I also think that I don't remember the name of the person who wrote this movie, but it almost strikes me like this person stopped watching TNG in season 5 or something, because, you know, TNG did a very good job of getting away from the plot line of let's put Troy in mortal peril, right? And they had her take the captain's exam, the command exam. They put her in a uniform. They gave her one of the best episodes of the series, Face of the Enemy. Like, she very much was not this person in the movies. And suddenly they put her into this role again. And it's very just like upsetting, and it's disappointing. You know, there would have been another way to do this. And I think that is really what it comes down to, is that so much of this movie, you're just like, there was a better way to do that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are plenty of ways to have somebody. I mean, there was that episode of Voyager where B'Elanna was getting visions from somebody else sent to her. Right. And They were painful. They were difficult to watch. She didn't want them anymore. But I don't remember the episode making rape parallels as much. And it just seems, I don't know, it seems like a bridge too far. And again, this is 2002. This isn't 2018. We are in a different place culturally, maybe, but we're not. Let's be honest with ourselves. We knew rape was bad in 2018, and we shouldn't in 2002, and we shouldn't have trivialized it then.
But I
don't know. Because I really like the scene when she figures out how she's able. Now, I don't know where she suddenly gets the ability to reverse the conduit from. But, you know, fine. Stress allows people to tap into abilities they don't normally have. Sure. I like her ability to, but at the same time, if viewing somebody's, if this kind of psychic assault on somebody's mind is directly compared to rape in this movie. Are we cheering on Deanna Troi because she gets revenge on her rapist by raping him back? Is that what this movie happened?
I mean, I will say that this is a little on the nose on the movie's part, but I think what they're trying to go for is that, you know, Shinzon and the Viceroy made this connection to Troi,
yeah,
while she was engaged in sex with Riker. And so, I mean, if she had been like reading a book,
yeah,
or something, I don't know that it would have been quite as bad. But I also think that it's part and parcel of the weird sexual menacing of Shinzon that he does to her. Because remember, in the first moment, yeah, they meet, he's like walking over to her and he's like fascinated by the fact that she's a woman and he's never seen a female woman and like all this kind of crap. And like he asks if he can touch her hair, which is just like, I mean, like it's. I don't understand some of these choices. It's, I think, just what it comes down to.
I don't know. When you hear about what was going on culturally in Hollywood, don't you understand some of the choices, actually?
Well, let's leave that aside and let's talk about the Riemanns, because...
Yeah. Now, have they been mentioned at all before this?
I don't think so. I think they were created for the movie.
Why? I mean,
it kind of makes sense. Romulus, Remus. Oh, it's funny, you know, whatever. But
it's funny in a way that worked in 1968, where you could have a planet called Romulus and have it not really feel that weird. But in 2002, the standards of realism are a little different, and it seems a lot hokier. And I don't know. On the one hand, it makes sense. Romulans are an empire. They would have underclass planets, sure. But this muddies the waters considering the unification arc, right?
Well, how so?
Well, because I don't know. This movie is, number one, really determined to forget that the unification arc exists, I think.
Sure.
And I don't know. Maybe it's just really because it's called Riemanns that I have the biggest problem. I guess this is dovetailing into something we alluded to earlier, which is, why are they Romulans and not just another species invented for the movie? Because I feel like a lot of the questions that we have of, well, gee, you know, we're finally seeing Romulus and this feels weird, would be elided if they just made up a new species for it. You know, now this is my exact question with Discovery too, though. Not maybe as dramatic. These are a lot closer to Romulans than Discovery Klingons are to Klingons, but...
Well, I mean, yes and no. And I mean, interestingly enough, the Klingons in season two of Discovery are going to have hair, and the new makeup looks a lot better with hair. Or a lot more close to, to sort of like TNG era Klingons, which, you know, I never had a huge issue with the new Klingon makeup. It was fine, whatever. I don't care that much. I don't like Klingons, so it wasn't a big thing for me, but you like Klingons, so it probably felt more of a violation to you.
Well, the makeup was one thing, but culturally they were very different. But anyway.
Yeah. We'll just have to see what happens in season two. But this is not a Discovery podcast.
Thank God.
Well, I somewhat agree with you, but I do appreciate the impulse to flesh out the Romulans a little more. Haha, pun not intended, but you know, they all don't have flesh at the beginning. Because why not use the Romulans, right? They have a long history in Star Trek, even if they're not like utilized the best. I think that they slot into this movie pretty nicely. And I think that if it had been an alien species invented for the movie, you may have the same exact criticism of why they just didn't use an alien species that had already existed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's the fact that the Romulans have this plot to clone Picard, like, does feel classic Romulan. And
yeah. Like they do use some of that stuff pretty well. Like I agree with you that feels very Romulan. And then of course, like they just kind of go, oh, whatever, let's just throw them on the Riemann homeworld because we're done with this.
Yeah. The questions about, well, how did they find before? How did they know that they would? All of that can be answered with, well, they're Romulans. They may not be the best at seeing their plans to fruition, but they could certainly make plans and start them.
And I think that really what the problem with the Riemanns is not necessarily the fact that they exist, because I could overlook the fact that they exist if they did something interesting with them.
Yeah.
But you know, they don't, like, they just make them these weird sort of like scary looking monsters that don't really have much of a personality and we are supposed to just assume that they are all what? I don't know. Like, they're just
it's a
slave race for the Romulans to mine their dilithium. The Romulans found their planet when they left Vulcan thousands of years ago, and it was right next to this, you know, planet. And they're like, well, whatever, we'll just do it anyway and take them over. And I don't know what we're supposed to get from any of that.
That the enslaved miners who are ugly are going to be violent and try and destroy Earth if you give them power. Which,
yeah,
when you consider that coal miners elected Trump, I mean, maybe this movie does foresee the Trump administration.
I don't know if anyone could foresee the Trump administration, but anyway.
It's not the worst of the movie's sins, but it is a very kind of it's one of the cliches. There are so many moments in this movie where it just doesn't. This is one that makes the less interesting choice.
Well, it just feels like, you know, you can do this sometimes in a movie, but this just has so many new elements that are introduced.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got B4, we've got Shinzon, we've got the Remans, and you're like, can we please take a rest here? We don't need all of this stuff. Like, I think the movie would have worked just fine without the Remans, right? Like, we already have a history of Romulans taking in half human or whatever people, like with Sela, right? And so I think that a strong argument could have been made that they could have just, why not have Shinzon have been taken in by Denatra?
Yeah, oh my god, that actually would make a lot of sense. You know, Denatra during a trip to the mines, because Denatra is a politician who wants to try and do the right thing for Romulus, and at one point she, you know, as she becomes more aware of the mines on Remus, she insists on visiting with an, you know, and she's very responsible. Maybe she's even responsible for closing them down and all of that, and, you know, that becomes her pet cause as a senator, and she meets up with Shinzon, and she takes pity on him, and she takes him in, and he's very much talking about, you know, these abuses that some of the government does, and all of those senators that are in there wanted the mines going, and remember how hard of a time, and they're and that's her motivation for getting rid of the Senate, because she feels that they are actually doing undue suffering at the expense, and so she is somebody who is extraordinarily good-hearted and wants to do the right thing and gets seduced into some violent ways of thinking. And yeah, but again, I want to see her movie. I am fascinated by her as a character, and this movie barely recognizes that she exists.
Well, right, because it just feels like this movie went through a bunch of rewrites and just got worse each rewrite. You know, like, so much of this movie, the motivations of so much of what happens are very obtuse, and you know, that is very obtuse. The Remans are very obtuse. The Remans are underutilized. I think if you get rid of the Remans or feature them very briefly, you also get rid of the most problematic elements of the movie, which are the mind rape. And also the B4 stuff. And how, like, did Shinzon and the Remans make B4? Did they find him? Like, I think he said they found him. How did they find him? And then why do they have this, like, elaborate plan?
Yeah.
Again, it's just like, this movie presupposes that no one is talking to each other, and if Shinzon just called up Starfleet Command and asked them the question point blank, this entire movie would not have happened.
Yeah, and maybe that's a much more interesting thing of it. You know, Shinzon does just openly call Picard there. There is no B4. There is no trap that way. He calls Picard there. He puts up his friendliness act for a bit longer. You have the same basic plot, except it's trimmed so much. Again, that's part of why I thought that they knew this would be the last outing. It seems like they're cramming in too much shit in there, because
they're cramming in too much shit, but it's all shit that we don't care about, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, and then every so often,
I'm just Well, Undiscovered Country was very much designed to be the last outing for that crew.
Yeah.
It feels like it. Whereas this one doesn't. I mean, it feels very... I mean, literally the movie ends with them rebuilding the Enterprise, indicating that it is going to have more adventures to come.
I mean, this could have been a very nice parallel to Undiscovered Country, which was about, okay, this era is ending because finally the Klingons and the Federation are forming at least a shaky alliance and being willing to move forward. I mean, I know that Next Generation didn't do a ton with the whole, well, we're the Romulans and we're back now kind of thing. But, you know, especially considering the unification episodes and all of that, TNG was at least interested in the Romulans, and it would have been interesting to have the TNG era capped with, and we've made peace with the Romulans, and they are going to begin to have a similar relationship that the Klingons do with this now. And, you know, maybe, the next generation from the Next Generation will feature a Romulan crew member. And
well, and this is part of what's so galling about this entire movie is that none of this movie ends up mattering because I know that you've seen Star Trek 09, and I don't know if you remember, but the Romulan solar system is destroyed in Star Trek 09.
Yeah, but so is Vulcan. I thought they were in completely different.
No, Vulcan is destroyed in the new timeline.
Oh God, I don't remember.
Romulus. Star Trek 09. The older it gets, the less I like it. The less well it's.
That's
aged.
Right. No. Sorry. That you're right. It's the future. It's roughly it's sometime past this was when he comes from, and then he travels back into Star Trek.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh, God.
Yep. So Spock could not stop the destruction of the Romulan solar system. So the Romulan Empire is now ostensibly either destroyed or in great disarray because the Romulan star system has been destroyed, including Romulus, their homeworld.
You know something? I'm starting to get really over timeline bullshit. The new season of American Horror Story was very much about timeline bullshit, and I liked it, and I think we're done with it now. Like, there is not going to be something that does it as elegantly or as fun as that, and it's just gonna – let's stop it. That's this era's.
Well, that's why I was so happy to see that Star Trek Discovery mostly stayed away from time travel shenanigans, and the one episode that did deal with time travel shenanigans,
localized.
It was in a very limited context, and it was one of the best episodes of the season.
Yeah.
So – you know, now I want to go back and watch that episode, but I have no way to watch it because I don't have CBS All Access. Although the first season of Discovery is on my Christmas list. Well, okay.
If only you had a time machine. If only you had a way to travel to Christmas so you could get the Discovery thing.
Well, I think there's one other big thing for us to talk about in terms of Nemesis, and that, of course, is Data's death. We have mentioned it, of course, but I think that this is the one part of the movie that works for me, and it's like on an actual good level. I think they handle his death very well.
Yes.
The little new prototype transporter that is shown at the beginning of the movie is used at the end. It is a nice little follow through moment. Data gets his moment to sacrifice himself a la Spock, and if it is a little derivative, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I think they're trying. There is a little to having their cake and eating it too with it. But, you know, it is a – I think it's a wonderful ending, particularly for that character, because what is the line that Kirk says at Spock's death is – he commemorates Spock's sacrifice by saying – of all the souls I've ever known, he was the most human. And while I'm very glad that they didn't echo that line here, but that sentiment very much is surrounding Data's death. He is somebody who sacrifices himself for the greater good. He is, as Federation, he has the most Federation death that you can have. And, you know, we've been saying this entire time, you know, Data has emotions. And I don't know. I think that his death demonstrates that to me.
I think so, too. And I also really appreciate that the movie basically ignores the existence of his emotion chip. And
yes.
This is more of the Data that I think both of us really loved from the series. And you know, his death is not perhaps as moving as Spock's death, but I think it works, and it works well, and it works for Data's more understated emotions.
Yeah.
And works for the relationship that Picard and Data had, because of course Kirk and Spock had a very warm friendship, and I don't know that I would say Picard and Data had a warm friendship, but they had a level of respect for each other that, yeah, that really does come through in that moment. And I think that Data's death is the moment when Data becomes human, because he is sacrificing himself for Picard and for, yeah, his family. And I think he knows that, and it's the one moment of the movie that really works for me.
Yeah, because it's the choice that Picard would make. There's the line that Picard says, you know, we must destroy the weapon or stop it. All other concerns are secondary. And he very clearly means in that moment, you know, my life as Picard is irrelevant. If you have the opportunity to destroy this weapon and it will kill me, do it. And Data's the one who finds the third option, but still recognizes all other concerns are secondary. That means my own life.
Yeah.
I really like the scene when he's immobilized before, and I feel like an asshole saying that every time, by the way.
The movie has done its job.
And I have talked fluently about Hugh the Borg, so, you know. When he's talking to him and he's saying, you know, oh, I have to, you know, shut you down indefinitely and all of that. And I think there's some really nice, subtle acting, oddly enough, from Brett Spiner in that, because it's very clear that he's kind of suppressing his emotions in that point. It is obviously awkward and difficult for Data at that point, and yet he knows I can't, you know, for the good of the mission, I can't turn him on. I can't try to teach him now. I'm not going to have the,
yeah,
you know, maybe Data even at this point is contemplating whether or not he, you know, if I need to sacrifice myself, how do I do that? Like, that may even be on his radar. He doesn't know if he's going to see this. And for obviously, Data is somebody who created a child, right? Data is somebody who is proud to call before his brother. And he's recognizing what a danger he is. And again, Data has emotions. He just recognizes that he has to swallow them sometimes. And I mean, that's an indicator of emotion to me. I guess the last thing I want to, I don't know. I know Patrick Stewart must have had a hell of a time doing all these shootouts, but
oh, he always wanted to.
Yeah, I totally get it. He is having a hell of a time. This is a guy who started off as a Shakespearean actor and now in his 50s, I guess, is playing an action hero. Like, he's having a great
60s, I think. Patrick Stewart is like 78 years old. So, yeah.
You know, but either way, it's unexpected. And you could tell when he goes on to do X-Men, he's going to have a lot of fun. Is that the best choice for this movie?
Action Picard is a thing, and that is always, a criticism that people make of this movie. I don't know. I mean, look, the movie is dumb at points, and the movie is aggravating at points. And I don't know that it is the most well served that we have ever seen the character of Picard, but I think if you want to see contemplative Picard again, you're just going to have to wait for the Picard series, because once again, Patrick Stewart is 78 years old, and so he's probably not going to be doing any shootouts in that. I mean, maybe that's a cop out answer, but I think that's how I feel.
I guess maybe I would have a different reaction to this movie a couple years ago than I would have now, because I know, all right, this isn't the last we're going to see of Picard. They know that this is probably one, maybe two seasons of that, and let's give him a proper send-off now. And,
yeah,
you know, I think they know what the stakes are right now for this Picard show and what needs to be done in order to, you know, do it properly. And it's my thoughts on it have evolved a little bit, but I think it's kind of wonderful that they had this opportunity. Great. If I didn't know that that was on the radar and I knew that this was the last time we see Picard, it would feel a letdown, because this is very much a not with a bang but a whimper kind of movie.
Yeah, because I think that, I mean, there's a couple of different ways I can take that, but I think that the way that I want to respond to that is that, you know, Voyager, Nemesis, Enterprise, which we did not get to and will not be getting to, I think really do represent the nadir of the Star Trek franchise. And it's a hard question, because I think that while this movie is okay, and you know, we were critical of it, but I think, you know, it's okay. It's not the worst movie in the world.
Oh no, I didn't throw up watching it or anything.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's no Final Frontier. Star Trek kind of petered out, I think, just as Trek about petered out. And, you know, I don't know why Star Trek died. I don't think anyone really has much of an idea or a real idea about why it died. There are a lot of theories. But I think the bottom line is that there was something ineffable about Star Trek at its best that just got lost in translation over the years. And I mean, I think actually Roger Ebert put it best in his review of Star Trek Nemesis, when he said that at this point, Star Trek is a copy of a copy of a copy.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. And I actually think that's a large part of why Voyager is so unsatisfying as a whole, is that they didn't really have any idea what to do with that show. And I think that they didn't really have any idea what to do with the TNG crew in movies. And the reason why they got movies is because it's Star Trek.
Yeah.
And they need movies, right? And at the end of the day, it just finally died. It finally petered out. It finally limped over the finish line and unceremoniously ended with the cancellation of Enterprise in 2005. And so, you know, I think that, you know, part of me is a little sad that we didn't get to finish Trek About, but on the other hand, I think it kind of makes sense, because that's also how Star Trek ended.
Well, I can say with Trek About, I feel like there's less and less to say. This is very much a thing of repeating ourselves. I mean, I feel like I have less and less to say every time, and it's just getting really repetitive, because I just don't have as much to say about Star Trek as I once did. It's repetitive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has always been a podcast that was very interested in ideas and subtext and allegory and analysis. And, you know, I mean, it became a running joke on our Voyager podcast, but a lot of times for like 10, 15, sometimes even 20 minutes before the start of an episode of Voyager, we would talk about Voyager as a whole.
Yeah.
We would start talking about DS9 or talking about TNG, because the Voyager episodes that we were dealt with that week just didn't have much to analyze.
Yeah, I don't know if Enterprise would have changed things or anything like that, but, you know, and I have friends who really enjoy Enterprise. They think it's such a different show in that way that it's worth at least checking out. And maybe I will watch it at some point, but, you know, maybe it would have had different things to say. But, I mean, as a whole, I'm not super into prequels, but I know I didn't like Discovery, but I don't know if you'd quite call that a prequel, but...
I mean, it's a prequel. I my feelings about Discovery are that it is a better show than Voyager. But that's not saying a lot.
No, but it has a clearer idea of what it wants to be. It has a lot more enthusiasm, and I also think there is a very different feeling between Season 1 Voyager and Season 1 Discovery. Season 1 Discovery is, you know, Season 1 Voyager is decadent and tired and, you know, less meaningful and kind of getting old, you know. And Season 1 Discovery is just inexperienced and not sure what it has to say yet, and not, you know, in certain parts it's too timid to make its own mark, in certain others it's too arrogant, you know, and I think it, it...
But at the same time, I mean, not to cut you off, but at the same time, you are describing the first season of The Next Generation.
Yeah, I think that's part of why, I don't know, you know, much as I joke, I probably will watch some of season two of Discovery, because season two of Next Gen, they did figure out. They just needed a little time to iron it out and get the kinks out. And if season, you know, I'm really excited about the Picard season, because number one, they've start, you know, this, it isn't the first toe in the water of this era. It's a second one, and with people who know what they're doing. I mean, we know who, we may not know quite who Michael Burnham is as a character. The actress, what's her name again? May not quite have her.
Sonequa Martin Green.
Yeah. Yeah, she might not quite have the handle on the character yet, because most people in season one aren't there, but Picard, we know who Picard is, and Patrick Stewart knows where Picard is. So it kind of has a little more of a head start than Discovery did. But now, but at this point, this is her second time playing the character. This is the second time they're writing the characters. This is the second time they're going into this universe. I think they'll have a better idea of it.
I think that's right. But I mean, I also think that you know, for me at least, you know, looking back on the totality of Trekabout, I think that the beginning of the end of Trekabout for me in hindsight was our Discovery coverage, because I think we both agreed that in hindsight it was a mistake to do that coverage, and we didn't really get much out of it. And I think it probably would have been better if we had waited, and maybe we would still be doing Trekabout. I don't know, but
I don't know. We would have been done with Voyager by now, or at least finishing it up.
Well, yeah, because I think that's part of the issue, right? That it just feels like we had been covering Voyager for so long, and part of it is that Voyager, you know, part of it is that Voyager, on the whole, is not a very good television series, and so it is going to feel longer because I was not as invested in it as DS9, for instance, and we both were very interested in getting to the finish line of DS9, and we're both very, very, very invested in the series. But also part of it is that we had a lot of delays with Voyager. I mean, we took that time off for Discovery. You know, we had other things going on behind the scenes that started to make it more difficult to record. And so we were going on this extended, you know, more expanded release schedule. And so it just started to feel like, you know, is Voyager ever going to end? And I think that it also is the case that I don't necessarily like the direction that Star Trek is going in now. And, you know, put this show in context, right? Like, Trekabout started in 2012.
Yeah.
And
I think
that was 3.5 years before the announcement that they were going to have a new Star Trek series on television. You know, the J.J. Abramsverse movies were there, but there were only two of them at that point. And, or one of them at that point.
I feel like,
God, Into Darkness didn't come out until 2013. Jesus.
Yeah, because I made a point to not watch it, and I probably would have ended up watching it at some point because I liked the first one fine enough.
Don't watch it, but I mean, watch it if you want to, but I'm not going to tell you what to do. But I think that's part of it too, is like, you know, the show was always designed around the Star Trek that I grew up watching, that I like, right? Like original series, TNG, DS9, you know, Voyager and Enterprise to a degree. And now we've got this whole other thing, and it became this thing of like, all right, Trekabout always had an end date. Now what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Are we going to keep doing all of the Star Trek for the rest of time? I mean, we have Discovery. We have the Picard series. We have this new animated series from the Rick and Morty person.
Oh, God.
So, listeners, I
fucking hate Rick and Morty. And this is our last episode, so I don't give a fuck anymore. I judge people who say they like Rick and Morty. Whenever somebody, I'm talking to somebody, and they say, oh, yeah, Rick and Morty's the best show, I judge them. Just watch a better show.
Is this the show I'm thinking of that I mean,
the sriracha sauce like show? Basically, okay. So if you meet
it feels like the kind of show that people that unironically refer to other people as cucks like.
There's some of that. A lot of sapiosexuals like this show. I mean, no, because like there's plenty of like left wing aligned guys who like it too. But it's a very it's a show that I would have had a very different opinion of at 25 than I do at 35, but it makes me feel old. It just makes me in a like my reaction to talking about Rick and Morty is just get the fuck off my lawn. Just go.
And now he's making a new Star Trek series.
Well, yeah.
And that but that's the question at the heart of it is that like did we want to continue to cover all of the new Star Trek series to the end of time? Like, no. That was not my goal, right? Like, even if they had made another one, I didn't think they'd be making 17 new shows. And I don't know. That's not the Star Trek I like, and I don't know that I would have had as much to say about it. And that's really the bottom line. You know, it the show did peter out, but I think if it wasn't for Discovery and the new Star Trek, I think we may have finished, but it just all started to feel a little too overwhelming. And also Voyager was really getting to me.
I mean, for me, and I know this was part of the problem with tuning in too, was that it's very exhausting to be reacting to a new thing every single week. We don't cover shit I know. And I kind of wanted to helm my own thing too, you know? I have been.
Yeah, I think that's.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm frankly waiting for American Horror Story to end because I've been talking with a friend about doing something with that. Like, I don't know. I don't want to do an indefinite series anymore. If I ever do something again, it's going to be like a, you know, 10, 12 episode. This is it. And then we're done forever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, too, is I mean, people have asked us if there's ever a chance that we would come back. And, you know, I made a joke in the comments on our site that I think the only way we would ever come back was if the Picard series was good. And maybe we would want to talk about that. But, you know, I mean, that was a joke. I mean, who knows if that's actually going to happen? Probably not, unless the Picard series is like the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Or if somebody wants to pay us. Like, I'll be hot.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to pay us, like, I don't know, $1,000 an episode to do it.
We'll do the Talking Dead for it, yeah.
But, yeah, I think that's right. Like, Trekabout always did have an end date, and that was the end date that we always had, was 2019. And it was looking like we were going to stretch into 2020 because of the various delays and Discovery. And then we were going to be coming back to it every now and again because Discovery and Picard series. And I'm just like, yeah, I don't want to do this. You know, it's not something that this podcast has been a longer period of my life than my longest relationship.
No, it's and the creative project I've been involved in the longest. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not to say that I disliked it. Obviously I did not. I really enjoyed doing this show with you and I really enjoyed the feedback from the listeners. And I think that it was really heartening to see all the comments we got on the Trek About Is Ending post. And people have been, I think the people that really got this show, really got it and really got something out of it. And it is a very different, you know, this is a very different type of Star Trek series, podcast, whatever, that a lot of people have seen or listened to. And I appreciate all of that. I appreciate the patrons we had for the almost 3 years we had a Patreon. But I think it was getting to be time, and that's really it. You know, that's really it. That's the reason.
Let's end with me, right? Because wasn't the entire point of the question, this podcast?
Yes.
I've seen the barest handful of Star Trek. I am not a Star Trek fan. Can we make Richard a Star Trek fan? I mean, this has been in my, you know, at this point, I'm obviously not as quite as infused with it as you were at the beginning of the podcast. You'd been, you know, a Star Trek fan since I think you were a kid, and you'd certainly watched all of it.
Yeah.
You've watched Enterprise, but I'm a DS,
in fact.
I am a DS9 fan, that I will say unabashedly. That I can definitely say. I want to watch DS9 again. I love that series. I have all of this great fanfic about it in my head. I'm not a Voyager fan. I get why people liked Voyager, but I don't think it's a show that is at all friendly to hardcore viewing. And I think a casual view of Voyager is a lot better. I think a cherry-picked view of TNG is better.
See, I would disagree with that, but continue.
Well, I mean, the maybe cherry picked is maybe implies that there are fewer bad episodes than good. But I guess what I'm saying is when I rewatch DS9, I would start it from the beginning and watch every single episode in order. I would go through – there are TNG episodes I would skip.
Yeah.
I guess is more of a way of saying that.
I mean, I would say that I'll let you continue, of course, but I want to frame it in a particular way, which I think is that I've known Richard for a long time and I know him very well. My opinion of you has always been that you are not really you're not a fandom guy.
No.
Right? Like, you don't have your fandoms. You're not a Batman guy or a Doctor Who guy.
No, and I also don't really hang out in fan communities either. I think that's fair right. To say.
Like, you appreciate art and you appreciate good art and you appreciate things that make you think and things that you will enjoy. But, I don't, looking back on the totality of this podcast, I don't know that there was ever much of a realistic chance that you were going to become, like, inured into the Star Trek fan community.
Yeah, I have I have the odd Star Trek doll around, but I'm not going to have, like, you go to your apartment and you have so much Star Trek. You have a case of all of the ships. You have a painting of Picard being licked by puppies. You have, posters of various starships,
This is all true. Yeah. I do.
Yeah, I can see that. That said, I still will consider getting that tattoo.
Well, there's always another opportunity to get a tattoo.
My birthday is coming up.
There you go.
But yeah.
Yeah, it feels, it's weird, right? Like, we should end this episode, but when we end it, it's over. Like, that's it. So.
Well. Yeah.
I mean, it just feels weird. Like, I just want to keep going, but I know we can't. So maybe we should just end it.
It is not a bad or a tragic thing to recognize when one has said all one needs to say and move on from there.
I think more white men should realize that. Yeah, I'm with you. I think we've said all we can say about Star Trek. And, in 10 or 15 years, if we all haven't been killed in nuclear holocaust or we're at the camps or whatever, and the new era of Star Trek is going and going strong and I really like it. And, who knows what's going to happen in the future. We can never say bands get back together all the time. But this is it. This is it. I mean, this is really it.
But I guess that because what I have gotten from this experience, though, is a sense of renewed hope and optimism, right? Because the era that followed this was a very dark era for sci-fi, and we are in a dark time in the world, but the backstory of Star Trek, whichever one you want to pick that they actually had, whether it was Eugenics War or the Bell Riots or everything's a little, contradictory. But there is a lot of dark backstory to Star Trek. And yet there is very much the sense that out of all of that, this can rise. Nobility can rise. And good things can happen and that people will learn to be better than they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And
so I guess
that's
the moral of Star Trek at the end of the day is be best.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not a bad lesson to learn. All right. Well, I think that's it. We'll call it an episode. I will end by thanking all of you who have listened to the show for these many years. We have done this show for over 6 years. This is our 322nd episode, not counting patron specials and Trek About specials and Tuning In and Trek About Presents and all other sorts of things. This, I think, was our most successful show and our best show. And yeah, I just want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen and engage with us. And thank you, Richard, for sticking with us for so long. And thank you for your hard work.
Thank you for yours. And I thought you were crazy when you proposed this. I still think you're crazy, but at the end of the day, I'm glad you did. And thank you to all the listeners, and thank you to all of the people who created the Star Trek.